my work begin. First, we take Manhattan.
It's a matter of time, I suppose.
Welcome to Watchmen Minute, where we're discussing the 2009 Zack Snyder film, Watchmen, 1 minute at a time. I'm Eric Nash from Almost Famous Minute.
My name is... I don't know what just happened there. I forgot my name.
Was it Richard?
Yeah, I was about to start with an R.
Robert?
My name is Travis Bowe from the Real Comic Heroes Podcast.
I am the Rock and Roll Reverend Andy King from Real Rock, part of Rock and Roll Archaeology.
Oh, great to have you, Andy. How you doing?
Good, man. How are you guys?
Yeah.
Doing well.
Very good. So this is minute 176 here on Monday, and it starts with Archie flying away from Karnak and ends with Laurie telling Sally she knows about Eddie.
Yeah, so we have Archie flying away, and this is just one of those pieces of music that I noticed, but I never gave a lot of thought to and didn't realize, you know, didn't know it was Mozart, you know. It's a really nice piece of music once I actually listened to the whole thing, and I do like it here in last week's minute and this minute. But
it actually reminded me of something else, which is the this is the piece of music that is referenced in Seinfeld.
Oh, okay.
Which is there? It's Elaine and Jerry standing on the street, and they're talking about. She's saying, "Did you know Mozart wrote this piece when he was dying?"
Oh,
he goes,
okay.
"Yeah, it was in Amadeus. Everyone knows that." But of course, that was a '90s thing, and we're over 20 years removed from that. So
yeah,
and that movie isn't as popular as it was. That's sure. For sure, unfortunately. Yeah. It's the main character is the guy is the main. Fraternity pledge and
yeah,
and from Animal House,
Tom Hulce.
So it's a crazy shift in acting and character that he's playing. He's actually more subdued in Animal House for being a fraternity where a lot of partying is going on.
Yeah, this piece was. It says it was commissioned in mid 1791 by some count, a friend. Franz von Walsligg, and it was a tribute to the passing of his young wife, Anna. So Mozart began the final composition and then passed away before he even had a chance to finish it. But it sounded like he kind of knew he was dying maybe and used it as a, it might have been towards the end, he might have been writing it more for himself, it sounds like. Uh-huh. But and then his understudy Franz Xaver Süssmayer ended up completing the missing parts of the Requiem.
So then it's actually one of the more interesting transitions, I think, is from that of being almost black, but there's this little bit of a graphical weird waves on the screen, which is ends up being a TV screen.
Yeah.
And who here has seen any Outer Limits? Anyone? Because I haven't. I mean, I just am familiar with it, certainly from this, and just a couple other little maybe pop culture reference points. I'm not even sure what.
Andy, have you ever watched any Outer Limits?
Outer Limits? Yes, I've seen all the Outer Limits, so.
Oh really?
Wow. Yeah, all cool. The Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, Sliders. If it's a sci-fi television show,
I'm definitely more experienced with the latter two. Those latter two.
I've only watched one episode of Outer Limits, and it was this episode.
Oh yeah,
the architect of yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to step on you there.
Oh no, that's okay. Yeah, I was curious because I knew that that episode gave Alan Moore a little bit of inspiration for the ending of Watchmen, and so I was curious if I could figure out, like, at the start of this episode that we see on this TV screen in Dan's apartment, you know, it starts to pan away from the TV, but then you can start to hear some audio, and I tried to really pay attention to that specific audio and ignore the sounds going on in Dan's apartment. And then I looked up the actual episode of Architects of Fear, and it matches up. So they did actually use the same episode, even though you don't see any of it.
I wonder why they didn't, like, go full out, because in the book it makes it, like, really obvious, because it goes, like,
Yeah.
Up next, Robert Culp in The Architects of Fear. And then, like, this one's just, here's the intro. That's an Easter egg. You know, it's kind of weird. It seems like they would have went, like, all out and told you. If for no other reason than to, like, hey, check out that show. Because that's where the end of this came from, minus the squid.
I think it was probably just a nice subtle nod for the fans, maybe, of the book who would know that would, you know, what that reference was all about. Because to a general audience of a movie-going audience, they might be familiar with Outer Limits. And then if you tell them, you know, that this episode is The Architects of Fear, like, maybe some of them would be familiar with it, but probably they're not going to know that there's a connection between that episode and Watchmen. So it's, you're probably not gaining anything by specifically mentioning it. Since you're already gonna, the fans of the book are already going to know what you're doing there.
Yeah. When I was in the theater, when I first watched the movie, I was like, I know what episode that is, because, you know, and then the people that were with me were like, yeah, nobody cares. So, yeah, I get it. Yeah. It's funny. That episode is that particular Outer Limits episode is based on a Kurt Vonnegut novel. So.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's based on the novel The Sirens of Titan from 1959, okay. I think. It's fascinating story about the.
Okay, well it's a Vonnegut, I see. Okay, that's one of the few Vonneguts I haven't read.
Almost everybody I talk to says the same thing. Like, I haven't read that one. Like, you should, because it's pretty much the same thing.
Hmm. Yeah. So the synopsis of the episode Architects of Fear says a secret group of scientists decide to surgically alter one of their members into an alien. In order to convince the world that an alien invasion is imminent, they hope that such a threat will force all governments to make peace with one another. However, such a complex plan has many vulnerabilities, including the wife of the volunteer. So I did watch this episode just a few days ago. I found it. It was online at dailymotion.com. It was pretty interesting. I was pretty entertained throughout most of it, especially when he is becoming this alien. They really play with the psychology of what the process does to a person, because it seems like it takes a few weeks to change him into an alien, because they're doing several surgical procedures and different all kinds of different procedures to remove organs or replace organs. Or I think they change his blood from an iron-based blood to something. I forget what other, you know, dominant element his blood's composed of. And basically they make him breathe nitrogen instead of oxygen. So it's really interesting.
Pretty extensive.
Yeah, yeah. Because they want...
It's not just a Hollywood fake... Fake.
Right.
It's a really scientific fake.
They wanted to guarantee basically that if he was discovered and killed and autopsied, that they wouldn't find out that he was a human, because then you're going to – that might ruin the plan. Yeah. You know. They really want people to believe that this guy's an alien. So, Andy, had you know of the Outer Limits and this episode before the Watchmen connection, or?
I got into kind of any kind of sci-fi at all, sort of post-Watchmen in my life, minus maybe The Twilight Zone, which I used to watch as a child. So I kind of, I'm one of those people that if I like something, I will obsess over it and have to find all the precursors, and this led to that, and this guy read to this, and this. And so by the time I get to it, Vonnegut begat The Outer Limits, begat Watchmen, if that's one way you want to think about it.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Well, one aspect of the Watchmen, that's where it comes from. So
I can appreciate that. I tend to lately been reading a lot of old comics, and when I come to something that previously on, or if you basically referencing something that happened earlier, I've been tending to go back and checking out that previous issue or whatever. So certainly fallen down several holes that way. So
that's how you find everything that's cool.
Well, before we get away from Outer Limits. Outer Limits even, is that the thing I noticed and I really felt like saying is the Kevin Smith connection.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's what I found most interesting, that you know, it was under through Warner Brothers, and before he was gonna write Superman Lives in 96, that they offered him two projects, and one was this, making a movie out of Architects of Fear, I guess. But then the other was the movie that's been talked about for years and years and years, the sequel, Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
Yeah. Pissed off we didn't see that.
They're still talking about it practically. except anymore, I guess he won't be going Hawaiian if they do end up doing something reasonably soon.
Kevin Smith's, I guess his first evening with, he does talk about, I don't know if he name drops the Architects of Fear in that story, kind of as he leads up to talking about writing Superman Lives, but he definitely mentions Beetlejuice back then, and it's definitely worth watching that evening with for that Superman Lives story alone. But
stuff with John Peters was fascinating.
Let's jump back to this minute a little bit. We hear Sally asking Lori if she wants a drink. Before that, we see Lori, and she's I noticed the flowers here on like a table by the window, and I noticed, you know, much earlier in the movie there were some yellow flowers on the restaurant table. But here we have their stargazer lilies, it looks like. So I looked up kind of what they symbolize, because I guess, you know, every flower has a meaning and symbolic for certain things. And stargazers are known for purity, especially in the spiritual sense instead of a religious sense. Optimism and reaching your goals even when they're among the stars. They also mean heaven on earth or reaching a paradise in the afterlife, as well as limitless opportunities, prosperity, abundance, and financial success. And then they are the, I guess, go-to flower for celebrating 30th wedding anniversaries. A little fun tip about the stargazer lilies.
It's kind of, you know, that name, it's got this sci-fi vibe to it, and some of that stuff there was apropos, I think. Kind of trying to leave the movie on a positive note.
Yeah.
They should have been poinsettias.
Yeah, if this is
at Christmas.
I don't know that. I mean, I know the book, it sets kind of the final scene at Christmas time when they go to visit her, but when we see towards the end of this week, we'll see a bit more of New York, and there's definitely, it's not a snowy, wintry New York, so I'm guessing this is even further from Christmas than, so I'm betting it is sometime in 1986.
It's one of those like random things that nobody cares about that they changed. The only thing really that kind of I wish they would have left in was when they originally show up, they have a false identity. They're the Hollises. They're Mrs. Hollis.
Yeah, right.
And I kind of like that, an epilogue to the story where they're like, yeah, well, we had to go get fake identities and stuff, and he named himself after Hollis Mason, and you know, things like that. It's the only thing that kind of like, I'm not normally a stickler for, you know, that's not like it was in the book, but that was something we could have they should have left in, I think, and didn't. That was my only criticism of the scene in general, other than makeup, but we'll talk about that.
Well, it kind of seems to me like it almost would take maybe like too much explaining, similar to the squid. We've certainly had that conversation throughout the whole movie, all our minutes, I think, you know, at various points. But it's just, you know, it's like, well, we're trying to be, we're in disguise. Whereas, I mean, the other dialogue we have here, I think is, you know, fairly to the point.
Well, it might be more, I mean, I guess it's still pulling from the book, but it might be more, I don't know, important to make sure that they drive home the, that Lori and Sally are going to start patching things up and at least coming to terms with what they both know. I definitely think that Sally looks, or Carla Gugino here as Sally looks much better than she did, whatever minute that was when we first kind of see her in the old, in the old folks' home. You know, I think they either, I don't know, the makeup that they've done to her somehow looks better. Maybe it's just because she's up and walking around and is wearing this nice dress. Like maybe that just adds to the, I don't know. She just looks younger, even though they've got her in some old age makeup, but she just looks, I don't know, healthier, more lively, I guess.
Or I mean, maybe that's an intention that, you know, people are just in a better, in a better state.
That could be, know,
Mentally and therefore physically, there's a supposed connection there.
That's how I read it, was that, or that's how I felt it, was that she was feeling better because everybody was kind of feeling better. Because my original notes, like when she popped up, and I scribble notes whenever I watch movies now. And my original notes were, if you ask Tim Burton to do Tammy Faye Baker's makeup, that's what would happen. And that was like my original thought on the first, like, you know, when we see Silk Spectre in the old age makeup, and then later on it's softer than it was before. I honestly thought that was intentional because everybody kind of seems a little bit more relaxed.
It could also have to do with I mean, I guess we when we see her in her retirement home, it is also supposed to be like a bright sunny day outside, even though the curtains are all, I think, drawn, and the lighting is just very dark in that earlier scene. And here it's still, I mean, for being a daytime shot, it's still somewhat dark, but it's one of the brighter, you know, scenes, I think, that we've seen in an interior like this. Because, I mean, inside Dan's apartment before, it was very dark and moody. So it might also just be that it's a lighter scene altogether, and maybe that helps her look a little bit younger.
Now I still have this this issue from, I can't even tell you exactly what minutes, but well, the minutes that where we actually, I can remember the guest, I think, Comic Geek speaker, Adam Murdo, I think, around there at least, if not him exactly. You know, here she says, never told you. And I still just have this issue where, you know, as a little girl, she, Lori was there hearing what her mother was saying about Eddie. And even though it wasn't fully explained, I think, in what Sally said, I thought there was enough there, and Sally just had that disappointed look, or you know, dialogue saying, "Oh no, what have I done?"
Yeah, I guess I still, I don't know. The fact that she says that I felt ashamed, I felt stupid, like I it breaks my heart seeing her like say these things, and she's looking down, like she can't even look at Lori, you know, because she feels this way, and it's really sad, you know. And Carla Gugino's doing a great job, I think, of conveying that. Andy, what are your thoughts on I guess on both Silk Spectres that we have here?
Well, performance wise, I'm not a huge fan of Malin Ackerman, and I'm not in this movie. I do love Carla Gugino a lot. Minus the makeup.
Sure.
But the scene itself was, I mean, it's there. It's pretty pivotal because it has to show the end of that arc where, you know, a lot of this movie is kind of based on like a Plato thing where if you lived inside of a hole and you looked out of a hole and you saw a whole different world, it's kind of the same thing, like the Matrix and Harry Potter and all that stuff's kind of built on Men in Black. this is the world as you see it, but it's not really, because there's all this outside of that cave that you never saw.
That's a good, yeah, that's a good analogy.
Especially with Silk Spectre 2, you kind of go through that whole arc with her. Because you, as the audience, I mean, you're just finding out about all this crazy shit that you didn't know existed. And then, you know, for her, it's very personal. So, like, we're all finding out that, like, the whole world's going to end because he can manipulate John's powers. And then she finds out that, like, holy shit, comedian raped my mom, you know?
Right.
It becomes, and then, like, not that so much that they're, quote-unquote, okay with that, but it kind of goes into more of, like, that's how I got here. Everything does happen, and I saw everything happen, and it goes back to what John says on Mars, or, you know, he thinks everything's calculated, but he doesn't factor in human life to that everything does leads to this, you know. And that was kind of his turning point, his arc, and his redemption. Versus is coming out to her mother and saying, I know why that happened, and, you know, kind of get why you had to hide it from me or whatever. And
sure.
And then, or I don't know if that's in the next minute or not, but where she says back that, you know, I can't hate the guy. He gave me you. It's really important to her. It's really important that, you know, we do see that scene. And I mean, cinematically, that scene's there to kind of calm you down after the climax.
Yeah,
sure. Well, and it's good to show that Laurie has had enough time to process it, because this certainly isn't, you know, the day after she found out all of this. It's definitely been some time has passed, and she is had time to think about it, and she's not as angry about it. She can say, you know, I know that Eddie Blake was my father without, you know, having an angry, disgusted look on her face. You know, and I think to process that information of where she came from and you know, the person, you know, that her father was, like, that's a lot to, I guess, process. So it's impressive, I guess, that she has handled it this well.
She does. She shows a ton of maturity. Her arc in the whole movie, to see her kind of actually have an adult, mature relationship and have to deal with things, and even things emotionally. It's important. It's very important for her character. And I know, you know, it's one of those, in superhero movies, we typically hate the come down scenes, or however else you want to describe it. But, you know, they're really important to, especially like that one. You know, it's not necessarily an exposition scene, but I mean, it is a, to calm down before we hit you at the end, you know.
Sure.
It works. It works in the guise of the movie.
Yeah. I notice here that Sally calls her Laurel, which isn't something that we get, but maybe I'm trying to think back. I want to say maybe the comedian says, you know, Laurel Jane, like,
yeah, I was thinking Jane.
When he's runs into her outside of the meeting. I think for the rest of it, I think Sally has called her Laurie. So it must be kind of, I don't know. It feels here like it's one of those, she only uses that name when it's like, when there's some emotion behind it, maybe, you know?
Yeah. It's not just the upset emotion.
Right. Yeah.
It can also be.
It's not just her casually saying, Laurie, is that you? You know? It's like, this is a grown-up moment. I don't want to miss pointing out Lori's earrings look like golden crescent rolls.
Well, and somewhat, I think, the Egyptian, you know, too.
Oh, because of the pyramids or the triangles?
I don't know if it's triangles. It's just that layered kind of, you know, there's just something there that has that Egyptian flair.
Sure.
To it for me.
I think they're really distracting in the upcoming minutes, because we get a lot of like side profile that we'll see. So it's hard not to notice them there.
Well, guys, anything else for the minute proper?
I'm good on this one. Andy, you got any final notes on this one?
I hated her makeup.
Oh, on Sally.
Yeah. It just, I'm sorry, like the whole movie, that and Nixon's makeup just.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was one of those, it took me out a little bit.
So, Andy, what is your history with Watchmen?
So, really liked comics as a kid. And then when I discovered rock and roll, I kind of put the comics away. And it wasn't cool at the time to... I really wasn't cool to like Bruce Springsteen when you're in high school, but it was better than, you know, having Batman underwear, which now would be okay. When I was in rehab in my early 20s, fighting a drug addiction, and somebody brought Watchmen in, or was on the bookshelf, and I yanked it off the bookshelf, and just because I didn't really want to read anything else, and I ended up reading it like 3 times in 1 week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I really identified with Rorschach. I have a Rorschach tattoo that kind of remembers, reminds me sometimes not to compromise evil, which is, you know, it's kind of weird, but it's something I live by to some extent.
Sure.
Watchmen, what it did for me, and I know it's like a deconstruction of the whole superhero trope, but it really got me back into comics, because then I started reading Batman again, because that's my favorite as far as superheroes. And so and that was when we were going into an incredible run, and I had all the like Dark Knight Returns and Dark Knight Strikes Back, and
sure,
the Long Halloween, the Killing Joke, you know, all the awesome Batman titles. So
yeah,
and I got really, you know, I got like really sucked into superheroes again, and then the movie, what was it, 2008 or 9? I remember being like really stoked after the trailer, because it had that Smashing Pumpkin song in the original trailer, and like me and my friends were like, "We love the Smashing Pumpkins. We love the Smashing Pumpkins, and they're in a fucking Watchmen trailer, you know." And
I love that part. Yeah,
I really was like, "Oh my god, that's fucking awesome. I love this. This is awesome." And I took a bunch of my friends over to see. We were all going to go see it, and they weren't real familiar with the Watchmen universe, and so I take them there, and then and I swear, this is how infantile some of my friends were. One of them saw like rated R for extreme nudity, and they were like, "Oh hell yeah!" And then I was like, "Okay, I've read the book. It's not what you think, right?" And so like we walked out, and then that same friend, who I'm not gonna name him, we walk out. He walks out, and he goes like, "I just seriously watched 3 hours of a blue dick, dude. And that's like, right. That's your fucking fault." And so,
yeah. And, try paying attention to what else is going on around it.
And honestly, over the years, I bet you I watch Watchmen. I read Watchmen once a year.
Okay.
At least, cause it's kind of, it's a comfort food book for me. And like now, where it used to be, you know, I could sit and watch rock and roll movies all day long and read biographies of rock and rollers, which is my first passion.
Sure.
I actually can't do that stuff for fun anymore, because I'm way too like it's job sometimes. And if I'm going to watch a rock and roll movie, like I can't watch a rock and roll movie without a notebook. And
sure.
And it's with Watchmen, I'm kind of over comic book movies in general now, because they're all kind of same movie over and over again. But I know the book and the movie, actually, I can just go back to a lot of times. It's like comfort food. It's like Office is always playing, sure. You know, when the kids aren't here, the Watchmen are always playing. It's just like one of those I can put in the background and look up, and it's, I have the same reaction to Watchmen that my dad has to Forrest Gump. Like if that movie's ever on, he'll stop what he's doing and he'll sit and watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like that with Watchmen. Like, if it's on, I'm going to stop what I'm doing. I got to check it out. Or it can be on while I do other things, you know, just because I'm that familiar with the movie. And I think both of those examples really kind of come down to soundtracks, how the soundtracks are used. You know, it's just like life where you hear a song and it takes you back to like, oh, fuck, that's 1999 and I'm making out with Nancy DiPaolo in the back of a car, you know. So, and Watchmen does that with music, and Forrest Gump does that with music, and Empire Records, and, you know, several other movies where they have like these really great soundtracks that you can equate it to your life and it becomes comfort food because of that.
Sure.
You know? And that's kind of my two cents movie wise. And that's why it stands out to me. It is definitely in my top 20 of all time of movies. Cool. No, it's a little bloated. I do dig that about it, actually, because it's so like, to me, it's like professional wrestling. Like, it knows how campy it is. So it kind of goes around again to being awesome. Cause sure, it's campy. It's bullshit on some levels, but that's what you're craving for.
Then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want bloated camp, that's a perfect fucking movie, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need that, because that's like pure escapism, is because, you know, there's never going to be a Dr. Manhattan in the world. I'm sorry to break people's hearts, but there's that's never going to happen. The science behind that is really just not feasible or make any sense whatsoever. It's not going to happen. You could have a Rorschach, you know, just a crazy psychopath. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is just like out of this world, and it's total escapism. And it's awesome because of it, opposed to being like tied down or trying to tie it into the real world that, you know, comic book movies try to do since Nolan. I like it because it's not. It's the exact opposite. It's just complete and utter camp, and I love it.
That's awesome. I really like that, you know, that it's that Watchmen, there's a personal connection there for you, and that's really, you know, interesting.
Very cool.
Do you want to tell our listeners about your show and where they can find it?
You can find my show, Real Rock, on all the podcatchers. If you just look up Rock and Roll Archaeology, we all share a feed there. You can also check out all of our shows at rockandrollarchaeology.com or pantheon.com. Our main show, Rock and Roll Archaeology, which is a storyteller version of the history of rock and roll, which may be the best thing on the internet. I'm not saying that because I'm biased or anything.
Right on.
My show, Real Rock, is a little bit more out there, so to speak. I'm a little more esoteric than anybody else. Rockandrollarchaeology.com. Check us out. If you like rock and roll history, come check us out, because we have very something cool for everyone. Coming up next, I have a dissertation on the Satanic Panic and how it relates to film. It's going to be delightful.
Okay. I don't know much about the Satanic Panic, so I
should. It's a
something to check out.
It is a fascinating time in American history.
So glad to have you on, Andy, and I think we'll be back tomorrow. We'll see what happens then. This was minute 176. That'll be 177 tomorrow on Tuesday. And until then, who watches the Watchmen? We do.
We do.
Watchmen are over.
Then we take Berlin.